طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This is John Roberts. This morning, the entire broadcast of This Week in Palestine will be devoted to Josh Rubner's presentation at Boston College about his just-published book, Shattered Hopes, Obama's Failure to Broker Israeli-Palestinian Peace. It is an incredibly well-researched analysis of the United States' dishonest brokerage of the so-called peace process. Josh Rubner is the National Advocacy Director of the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. Here he is, speaking at Boston College.
So picture the scene, if you will, after World War I, when the victorious Allied powers gathered together in Paris, France, for what came to be known as the Paris Peace Conference. At this conference, Paris became the center of the political world. More than 32 countries and nations were represented by their diplomats in Paris, and more than 100 different causes pressed their case there in Paris. And in 6 months, what the Allies managed to do was to completely obliterate empires that had existed for hundreds of years. The Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Ottoman Empire, for example. And in the place of these empires that died out as a result of World War I, lots of new countries were established. And in fact, what the Allies did in Paris was to literally redraw the map of the world as they took colonial mandates over extensive areas of Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. Now, don't get me wrong, a lot of the decisions that the Allied powers made in Paris in 1919 were actually really bad ones. And if you look at today's Middle East especially, the border conflicts that are taking place, the sectarian and communal warfare that's taking place in countries like Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, a lot of that tension that we see today is directly attributable to poor decisions made by the Allies before, during, and after World War I. But I raise this point to say that the entire map of the world was literally withdrawn in 6 months by the Allies in Paris. Now, closer to our time, South Africa had 350 years of racial discrimination between the time when Dutch colonizers arrived in the 17th century and up until the 1990s. And for more than 40-plus years, you had a system of institutionalized racism in South Africa known as apartheid, from the Afrikaner word meaning apart or separate. When the apartheid government of South Africa decided finally to end this system of institutionalized racism against the 90% of black South Africans who were the country's majority and still are today, they sat down with the ANC, the African National Congress, and negotiated an end to apartheid in 3 years. 3 years of negotiations ended 350 years of formalized racial discrimination in South Africa. And in the fourth year of this process, Nelson Mandela was elected the first post-apartheid democratically elected president of South Africa. That whole process took 4 years. Even more recently, more than 800 years of communal conflict was ended in Northern Ireland through a negotiating process that took 2 years, culminating in what was known as the Good Friday Agreement, that resulted in power sharing between the different communities in Northern Ireland. Now, why do I raise these examples of historical conflicts that were adjudicated and resolved in a relatively short period of time? I do so because, as some of you may be aware, earlier this month, we marked 20 years since Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization came together and signed what was called the Declaration of Principles on the White House lawn. Perhaps you've seen it if you've taken courses on the Middle East or the Israeli-Palestinian conflict here at BC. You may have seen that picture of Bill Clinton standing on the White House lawn with his arms outstretched, beckoning in a very reluctant Israeli Prime Minister, Yitzhak Rabin, and a very exuberant and overjoyed Palestine Liberation Organization Chair, Yasser Arafat, for a historic handshake. Now, what the DOP, the Declaration of Principles, did was it set up a 5-year framework for resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And the theory for this, quote, peace process was that first, the parties would tackle interim issues that were a little bit easier to deal with than the issues at the core and the crux of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So what it involved was Israel redeploying, but not withdrawing, from some Palestinian areas that it had placed under military occupation since 1967. It involved the establishment of what came to be called the Palestinian Authority to administer a very limited form of autonomy over some parts of these Palestinian territories that Israel has occupied since 1967. And the idea was that by year 3 of this process, the negotiators would come together and they'd sit down and they'd hash out all the difficult issues that still remain to be discussed, what are called the permanent status issues. These are things like the status of Jerusalem, which of course both Israel and the Palestinians claim as their capital. It involved the fate of now 5 million registered Palestinian refugees who in 1948, they and their descendants today, were exiled from what became Israel in a campaign of systematic ethnic cleansing that accompanied the establishment of Israel in 1948. And those refugees still languish today in refugee camps, both in occupied Palestinian territory and throughout the Middle East. There were other permanent status issues like water, security, borders for a future Palestinian state that were also supposed to be negotiated. But what happened, or more accurately, what didn't happen during these negotiations was actual negotiations on these issues. They never really happened. Up until July of 2000, when the Israeli Prime Minister at the time, Ehud Barak, said, let's make a deal. Let's resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict right here, right now. And so he called Bill Clinton and said, can you convene a summit? And Bill Clinton said yes. And so Bill Clinton called the Palestinian President Yasser Arafat and said, come to Camp David, and we're going to sit down, the three of us, and negotiate a historic resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Now, Arafat said, whoa, hang on just 1 second, because none of the preparatory work has been done yet to bring us to a summit. Because if you study international diplomacy or international mediation, you'll find that it's never the case that the heads of state come to a summit to actually do much negotiating. Instead, the actual negotiations are done by the experts at a lower level. And then the heads of state come together to iron out any remaining difficulties and sign on the dotted line. So Arafat tried to explain that to Clinton. But Clinton said, don't worry, my friend. If these negotiations don't work out between you and Israel, nobody's going to get blamed. You have nothing to lose by coming here and trying. And so the invitation arrived in the mail. Please come to Camp David. And when you get invited to a summit by the President of the United States in our unipolar political system where we have one superpower, one hegemon, you can't really refuse that request very easily. So Yasser Arafat went to the summit with the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. And we've heard a lot since that time of the supposed, quote, generous offer that was made to Palestinians at Camp David in 2000. Well, in fact, this so-called generous offer of what Israel was willing to offer to the Palestinians for a supposed independent Palestine was actually never put forward formally. There was never any map put forward to the Palestinian negotiating team saying, this is what you're actually going to get. And in addition to not specifying what this Palestinian state would actually look like, Barak at Camp David also said, well, you can have a symbolic presence, but in the suburbs of Jerusalem, you're not going to have any real sovereignty in our united eternal capital. Forget about it. And he also said, forget about Palestinian refugees who were exiled from their homes in 1948, exercising their internationally recognized right to return to their properties and the lands from which they were expelled. Forget about it. All that's off the table. But this was presented as a very generous offer. And what happened was that Israel and the United States pre-coordinated their positions there at Camp David and put severe pressure on the Palestinians to accede to this deal in which there actually wasn't a map to show them what the deal actually was. And so after about 2 weeks of this very futile negotiating process, finally the time came to declare failure because Yasser Arafat, I think quite rightfully, refused to sign on the dotted line, especially since Israel wasn't willing to give him a map to show him exactly what the Palestinians would get. It seems pretty obvious that if you're going to be marking the borders in a peace negotiation, there should be maps put forward about where those borders are actually going to be. So he said, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to accept this offer. And actually what he said, if I do, I'll be assassinated. And he would have been, because he would have been seen as selling out legitimate Palestinian rights. And so what happened after Camp David? After the negotiations broke down, about 1 hour afterwards, Bill Clinton stood up at a lectern at Camp David in front of a press conference, and he said, I blame Yasser Arafat and the Palestinians 100% for the failure of these negotiations. Despite having told Arafat a few weeks earlier that no one would be to blame if these negotiations broke down. Now, why do I relate this story, which is not related in the book since it predates the years that I cover in the book? The reason why I bring this up is because I think it is a supreme example of how the United States has failed to be an honest broker, how the United States has been a dishonest broker, in the words of Columbia University professor Rashid Khalidi. The United States has been a dishonest broker to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And that is why it hasn't worked. That is why these negotiations continue to drag on and on and on and on with no end in sight. Because you can have a very complex, difficult, emotionally charged set of issues, and all of those things were present after World War I with South Africa, with Northern Ireland, with the decolonization and independence of Algeria in 1962. Every international conflict has heavy symbolism and emotional qualities to them and complexities. But that doesn't mean they need 20 years to negotiate. What they need is the political will to actually resolve the conflict, and you need unbiased mediation. Sort of like what Theodore Roosevelt did in 1905 when Russia and Japan came to him and said, we need help ending our war. Will you help broker peace? And he said yes. And he acted as that honest broker in those negotiations. and actually won the Nobel Peace Prize for doing so. But this is not at all how the United States has acted for the past 20 years since that handshake on the White House lawn back in 1993. And in fact, I think the people who explain best how the United States is not an honest broker to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict are those U.S. officials who actually were the key peace process players. So, for example, Dennis Ross, who was the prime peace process player in the Bush 1 administration and all throughout the Clinton administration, he didn't view his role as being an honest broker. And in fact, in his book, The Missing Peace, he calls what he did not brokering peace, but selling. And he said selling became our MO, our modus operandi. And he said that what we would do as these U.S. peace process players would be to take Israeli ideas or ideas that Israel could live with and work them over, making them more attractive to the Arabs and getting the Arabs to scale back their expectations. Now, under what definition of honest broker does that description fit? You can't credibly say that you're an honest broker when you're taking one side's ideas and trying to force them on the other side, especially when those ideas are so beneficial to the party that's proposing them. It simply doesn't make sense as a conflict resolution mechanism. Aaron David Miller, who was also a key peace process player, that's a mouthful, peace process player, during the Clinton administration and during part of the Bush 2 administration, actually said it quite well. He said in 2005, after he had quit government service, that we've acted as Israel's lawyers. That's a direct quote, as Israel's lawyers. And he said in the Washington Post that what we've done as a country is cater to every whim of Israel at the expense of successful negotiations. And he said something that I agree with very much. He said, if we're going to be a broker to the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, then we can have one client and one client only. Not Israel, not Palestinians, but the requirements of a just and lasting peace. And so if we ask ourselves, why do these Israeli-Palestinian negotiations seem to and actually drag on interminably, we have to understand the role that the U.S. plays in siding with Israel in these negotiations. And I said before that you have to have the political will to broker an end to a conflict. If the political will is not there, no amount of negotiations will resolve the conflict. If a party's not ready to come to the table, especially one like Israel and its relation to the Palestinian people, which is not one of two sides, two even sides. No, this is a situation of oppressor versus oppressed. This is a situation where one side to this conflict has their individual and collective national rights, and the other side has very, very limited or zero political and human rights. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is not one between two even parties, equal in strength. It's a situation of apartheid, just like South Africa was a situation of apartheid. And I know it's an Afrikaner word. I understand that. And I know that the analogy is not perfect because there are lots of differences between Israel, Palestine, and South Africa, undoubtedly. But apartheid goes beyond the political institution that was created in South Africa from 1948 until 1994. It actually assumed an international definition in the 1970s when the United Nations passed a resolution on the crime of apartheid and its suppression. And in this convention, the UN defined apartheid as any form of institutionalized governmental discrimination that's based on race, based on ethnicity, based on religion, based on nationality. And that's exactly the situation that obtains today between Israel and the Palestinian people. It's a situation where there's one set of laws and one set of rights if you're an Israeli Jew. And if you live under Israeli control or Israeli domination and you're Palestinian, then you have lesser or none of these rights. Now, what am I talking about? The Palestinian people are split into basically three components today. In the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, which is only 22% of historic Palestine, in other words, those parts of historic Palestine that are not what is today Israel, right? So Israel is 78% of historic Palestine. The occupied Palestinian territories of the West Bank and Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem, 22%. In these territories, you have 4.5 million Palestinians who live under the most brutal military occupation conceivable, where you have absolutely no human or individual or collective political rights, where every movement is restricted by Israel. Israel controls whether you can leave your village. Israel controls whether you can get out of your city. Israel controls whether you can move to go to the hospital, to go to the market to buy food, etc. This 22% of historic Palestine that's under Israeli military occupation since 1967 is about one-fifth the size of New Jersey. Okay? So we're dealing with a small territory here. And think if one-fifth of New Jersey were cut up by more than 600 checkpoints and roadblocks and all kinds of fences and military bases and roads that you couldn't use if you were an American citizen and walls surrounding you at every point and firing zones for the military that you weren't allowed to be on. That's the situation today for Palestinians living under Israeli military occupation. So that's one component of the Palestinian people. And I should say, too, as well, that the Gaza Strip deserves special mention for the brutality of the blockade that it's been put under since 2006 by the Israeli military, where Palestinians living there are denied access to clean water. They're denied access to construction materials like concrete for building homes. They're denied access to adequate nutrition because of Israel's comprehensive blockade on the Gaza Strip. So that's the situation if you're a Palestinian living under Israeli military occupation. But if you're an Israeli citizen who lives as a colonizer on Palestinian lands, there are now 650,000 of them, according to the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. None of this applies to you. If you're a Palestinian, Israel can arrest you and throw you into jail under something called administrative detention, which means you'll be held without access to a lawyer, without charge, and without trial for up to 6 months. And then when those 6 months are done, it can be extended for another 6 months, indefinitely. Kind of like what we're doing in Guantanamo, where people are held without charge or trial. But if you're an Israeli settler and you throw a rock at a Palestinian or you burn down a Palestinian olive tree or you kick or spit on or shoot at or run over a Palestinian, which unfortunately is almost an everyday occurrence, that doesn't apply to you. You have one system of laws if you're an Israeli Jew, where you're brought before a judge within 48 hours. And if there's no charges against you, you're released. But if you're Palestinian, you can be held without charge or trial. This is one of many clear examples of how there is a different set of laws for Israeli Jews and for Palestinians, based on their nationality, based on their religion. This is the definition of apartheid. If you're one of the Palestinians who were not ethnically cleansed from your home in 1948 when Israel was established and Israel engaged in a systematic campaign of exiling and ethnically cleansing Palestinians from this new state of Israel, driving out almost 750,000 Palestinian refugees, demolishing 400 to 500 Palestinian villages and towns, and razing them to the ground. If you're one of the few Palestinians who weren't ethnically cleansed back in 1948, then you remained under military occupation until 1966. And eventually you did gain Israeli citizenship. And yes, these Palestinians do have some political rights. They can vote in the Israeli parliament, for example. They can run for the Israeli parliament, for example. But if you're Palestinian and you've lived, let's say, in the city of Nazareth, where Jesus was born, well, sorry, he was born in Bethlehem, of course, but from Nazareth, if you have lived in Nazareth for centuries, let's say you want to build a new house, or you want to build an addition to your house, or you want to build a house for your children. Well, I'm sorry, you can't do that because you're the wrong nationality. You're the wrong religion. What are you talking about? Israel, unlike every other government in the world, doesn't control its land planning and its land use. Instead, it's contracted out to an agency called the Jewish Agency, which is kind of this quasi-governmental institution. And the Jewish Agency says in its charter that the land of Israel, meaning all of historic Palestine, is reserved for the privilege of the Jewish people. Not for Israeli citizens, right? So if you're an Israeli citizen and you're Palestinian, there are 1.5 million of them today. Sorry, this land isn't for you, even though you pay taxes here, even though you're theoretically able to vote here, etc. So there's this widespread societal discrimination against Palestinian citizens of Israel that places them somewhat in a situation that's kind of analogous to the way the U.S. was in the Jim Crow days. Finally, if you belong to a Palestinian family that was ethnically cleansed from your home in 1948, as I mentioned, today you live as a refugee, unable to exercise your internationally guaranteed right to return to your home. And even though the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says that every single person has the right to leave his or her country at any time and for any reason, and to return at any time and for any reason, and even though when Israel became a member of the UN in 1949 and said, yes, we stipulate that as a condition of joining the UN, that we are going to agree to allow Palestinian refugees to return to their homes. Despite these things, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and Israel's declaration for joining the UN, today, more than 65 years later, this right has still not been implemented for Palestinians, which is why they remain in refugee camps today. There are now more than 5 million Palestinians. So if you're Palestinian, sorry, you're of the wrong nationality, you're of the wrong religion, you don't have the right to move back to your ancestral homeland, but if you're Jewish, then you can claim citizenship. You can move there and ask for citizenship and get it the next day and buy that piece of land that Palestinians are denied. This is a system of apartheid that obtains today in all of historic Palestine, Israel, and the occupied Palestinian territories. It's a system where Israeli Jews enjoy privileged rights and Palestinians have very few, if any, political rights, depending on their situation. And the problem with this so-called peace process of the last two decades is that it has not aimed at ending this system of apartheid, ending the system of discrimination and inequality between Israelis and Palestinians, but the reverse. Entrenching this apartheid, and in particular, entrenching Israel's military occupation of the West Bank and East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip. This is why the peace process has failed and will continue to fail until a time when Israel comes to the table like the apartheid South African government did and says, as a precondition to these talks, we are recognizing that we are dismantling the apartheid structure. We are committed to a process of democracy and equality. And only then could the ANC come to the table and say, yes, let's negotiate. But that hasn't happened yet. That's why we've had 20 years of negotiation to allow Israel to entrench its military occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza Strip. When this process started 20 years ago, there were 250,000 Israeli settlers. Today, there's almost three times as many. And what these settlements have done is very strategically taken all the high ground, taken the land atop all the Palestinian water resources in the West Bank, encircled all Palestinian population centers, and made the idea of a viable Palestinian state in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip impossible unless these settlements are actually dismantled. So what I did in this book was I asked myself, was President Barack Obama different in his approach to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict than his predecessors, who acted as Israel's lawyers, self-admittedly? And I said, on the one hand, yes. On the one hand, no. Barack Obama was and was not different from his predecessors. So, for example, he was different in the fact that no other sitting U.S. president came to this position with as much personal understanding of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And, I think more importantly, more contact with and understanding of and empathy with the Palestinian narrative of suffering and dispossession at the hands of Israel. As a state senator in Illinois, Barack Obama had a very large Palestinian-American constituency. And it was a regular occurrence for him to go to community functions, to have Palestinian-Americans over for dinner. And in fact, I recount in the book, remember I mentioned Professor Rashid Khalidi, who wrote a new book called Dishonest Broker, which is a good compliment to the one I wrote. He used to teach at the University of Chicago, where in Barack Obama's state Senate district. And he would go over to his house for dinner all the time. It was a regular occurrence. Barack Obama had many Palestinian friends and knew this history very, very well. And this empathy didn't leave when he got into the White House, by the way. So, for example, when he went to Cairo, do you remember when he went there in June 2009, 6 months into his term, to try to reset relations with the Muslim world? He said that he understood the history of Palestinian dispossession and talked about Palestinian refugees waiting to return to a homeland and for a life of peace and security that they've never been able to enjoy. And he talked about the daily humiliations that Palestinians are subject to under the nearly half-century Israeli military occupation. And this statement that he made in Cairo far exceeded any empathy that any U.S. president had shown for the Palestinian people before. Barack Obama was also different because he broke with this tradition of appointing someone as Israel's lawyer to the position of peace process broker. Instead, what he did was he appointed former Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell as his special envoy for Israeli-Palestinian peace. And George Mitchell was the person who successfully brokered the Good Friday Agreement, leading to an end to 800 years of conflict in Northern Ireland. Here was a person who had the credentials and the knowledge and the principles of sound conflict resolution to actually be an honest broker. And through leaked documents from within the Palestinian negotiating team that were made public in 2011, you can see that the Palestinian negotiating team was very excited by George Mitchell's appointment. And they said, finally, we might get the fair shake from the United States that we've been denied for so long. And on the flip side, the Israel lobby was incredibly worried by this development. And one of the heads of a major Israel lobby group called the Anti-Defamation League, Abe Foxman, came out and publicly condemned the Obama administration for being neutral. He thought it was a bad thing that we have a neutral policy. As if that weren't a sound prescription for conflict resolution. And the third reason why I think that Barack Obama was different from his predecessors is because whereas during the Clinton years, during the Bush years, there were many, many calls on Israel to stop its settlement of Palestinian land. They were described as obstacles to peace, as being unhelpful to the peace process, etc., etc. But Barack Obama meant it when he said that Israel has to stop colonizing Palestinian land. He was serious about it. He was vehement in his insistence. So much so that when the Israeli foreign minister came to Washington in May of 2009 and said, well, we need to expand the natural growth of these settlements because we need new religious institutions and we need more nursery schools and you can't stop our daily life from going on. Well, Hillary Clinton stood right next to him as Secretary of State and she said no. To his face, no. She said, when we mean that Israel has to stop its settlement activities on Palestinian land, we mean it, and all forms of it. And this was an incredibly forceful position that was put forth. Not since Jimmy Carter was president, probably before you all were born, had a U.S. president said and acted in such an insistent manner that Israel stop colonizing Palestinian land. So yes, Barack Obama was different than his predecessors coming to this issue. So what happened? Why was there so much hope for change on this issue, yet so little movement and so much failure? Remember I said on the one hand, on the other hand, Barack Obama was different, but not so different after all? Well, let me give you the not so different part. Like every U.S. president since Richard Milhouse Nixon, Barack Obama increased the amount of military aid that we provide to Israel. And in fact, there is no disagreement at all between Israeli politicians and U.S. politicians that this level of military aid and military coordination and cooperation rose to unprecedented levels over the last 5 years. Unprecedented levels. Nobody disagrees with that statement. And in fact, just 3 months after Israel had murdered more than 1,400 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip in December 2008 and January 2009, just 3 months later, Barack Obama approved the delivery of 300 shipping containers full of more weapons to Israel, as if it weren't our bombs that were being dropped on those Palestinians in Gaza. As if it weren't our white phosphorus that was burning to death Palestinian children who were attacked with this white phosphorus chemical weapon in their schools. As if it weren't our F-16s and Apache helicopter gunships and Hellfire missiles that were killing so many Palestinians. Against U.S. law, I might add. Because U.S. law says very clearly in the Arms Export Control Act that you cannot use weapons against civilians. And that if you commit these human rights abuses against civilians, here's what happens. You don't get any more weapons from the United States. But instead of standing on the side of U.S. law and morality, Barack Obama decided to give more weapons to Israel in the immediate aftermath of killing 1,400 Palestinians. And this was a prelude, again, to the most unprecedented elevation of these ties. And when Barack Obama went to Jerusalem in March of this year, actually I think he went right at the same time that I was here last time, he said, I'm going to extend U.S. military aid to Israel all the way up until 2028, and that's going to be a signature component of my foreign policy in the second term. And his administration leaked to the press that what he wants to do is negotiate $40 billion of weapons to Israel over the next 10 years. At the same time, The government's about to shut down in a few hours, it seems. I haven't heard any updates that the shutdown's been alleviated. But because our government can't do the most basic task that we elect them to do, which is to pass a budget, we've had this sequestration for the last year. And so domestic programs have been cut across the board. And we have a situation in this country today where seniors on Medicare literally can't afford cancer-fighting drugs because of sequestration. We can't reimburse seniors for cancer-fighting drugs. But we have $40 billion to give to Israel in weapons to oppress and injure and kill Palestinians. What kind of sense does this make? What does this say about our priorities as a country and how skewed our policies are toward Israel and the Palestinian people? Number two, like other presidents, when faced with pressure by the Israel lobby, Barack Obama capitulated to it. And you see this very clearly in the documents that were leaked in the Palestine Papers that I mentioned before and also through WikiLeaks. And it happened very quickly in June of 2009 when Obama told this guy, Dennis Ross, the one who referred to his job as selling Israeli ideas to the Arabs, he moved Dennis Ross over to the National Security Council. And he said, Dennis Ross, from now on, you're going to be my, quote, quarterback on all Middle East issues. And Ross said, thank you very much, Mr. President. That's great because the problem, and this was his quote, the problem is that you've been focusing on one issue and one issue only, which is Israel's settlements. And that's not really that important after all. And you really have to understand the context in which Israel is continuing to colonize Palestinian lands, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, moving back into this model of making excuses for Israel's colonization of Palestinian land and acting as Israel's lawyer. And that's exactly what Ross proceeded to do. He pulled the rug out from under Mitchell's efforts, and any hope that the Obama administration had of being even-handed was out the window. Third, like other presidents, the Obama administration, or Barack Obama for that matter, provides Israel with the diplomatic protection at the UN that it needs to continue to flout human rights and international law and Security Council resolutions. Did you know that there are more than twice the number of Security Council resolutions that Israel is in violation of than was the case with Saddam Hussein's Iraq? More than twice the number. So why is Israel continually allowed to get away with not listening to the international community? It's because the United States stands there as the stopgap and says, we will not allow the international community to do anything about Israel's intransigent behavior. And you can see this very clearly. In February 2011, the Security Council put forward a resolution saying, we condemn Israel's settlement activity on Palestinian land and call on them to stop. The exact same thing that the Obama administration had been saying for its first 2 years in office. Now, one would expect logically when the UN puts together a policy that's exactly the same as your country's policy, you would say, oh yeah, of course we'll agree and we'll vote for that. But the Obama administration exercised its one and only veto to prevent the Security Council from passing this very mild resolution. Why? In the words of Susan Rice, the U.S. ambassador to the UN at the time, she said, well, don't construe this to mean that we actually agree that Israel should be continuing with this settlement activity, but we don't want to do anything that will harm the peace process. As if Israel continuing to gobble up Palestinian land isn't what's harming the peace process and the chances for an independent Palestinian state. We had a pizza dinner before coming over here, me and some of the Students for Justice in Palestine, which was very apropos because I always liken these Israeli-Palestinian negotiations to negotiating over pizza pie. And it's kind of like if I were to take 78% of the slices and say, well, this is all mine. You can't touch this. This is off the table. We're not negotiating about it. You can't have any of your side eat from my piece of the pizza. This is what Israel is, 78% of historic Palestine. But I'm going to be very, very generous and sit down with you and negotiate how we're going to share the little bit that's left of this pizza. But don't eat your pizza yet, because I'm a little hungry. So I'm going to start eating from your slices. I'm going to continue eating and eating, but don't object to it, because I'm going to be very generous, and I promise you I'm going to negotiate with you over how we're going to share these remaining slices, all the while continuing to eat it. And so what's left of this pie today for the Palestinians? Disconnected, discontiguous, isolated little pieces of land that don't look like anything that could be a viable state. Instead, they look like what George Bush referred to them as Swiss cheese. He said the West Bank looks like Swiss cheese because of Israel's settlements. And so our protection of Israel at the UN allows it not only to continue this illegal colonization of Palestinian land, but it also allows it to continue to commit war crimes with impunity against Palestinians. Now I'm going too long, so I want to skip ahead a little bit. Because where are we today? We are in a period where there are renewed negotiations. And John Kerry, Secretary of State, has said there is going to be an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal by the spring of next year, 2014. Why this sudden rush? Why this urgent deadline? Because 6 months ago, when John Kerry was confirmed as Obama's new Secretary of State, he testified before Congress that there's a one-year window. There's a one-year window left for creating a two-state resolution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. So even he recognizes that it's now or never. So will these negotiations be successful? Is Barack Obama going to be better in his second term than he was in his first term? I actually think the reverse is true. I think he's worse today than he was in his first term, and certainly at the beginning of his first term. Why? Because in his first term, he did try to stop Israel's colonization of Palestinian lands, and when that didn't work, he at least put up the pretense that the United States really wanted this. This time around, there's no pretense. John Kerry was in Latin America in August, and a journalist asked him at a press conference, after Israel had announced the expansion of yet another settlement during these negotiations, the question went something like this. Are you aware that Israel is going to be announcing the expansion of settlements on Palestinian land while they're negotiating over a Palestinian state? And John Kerry said something to the effect of, yes, we understand that Israel will be doing this, but we don't want this to be a hindrance to the success of these negotiations. Again, as if it's not Israel taking up Palestinian land that's not a much, much greater hindrance to the success of these negotiations. So here you have the active complicity of the Obama administration this term with Israel's ongoing colonization of Palestinian land. Second, there's no more pretense of being an honest broker. Instead, the Obama administration has reverted to this tradition of appointing someone who is transparently pro-Israel. And the person who's now the special mediator for Israeli-Palestinian negotiations is a fellow by the name of Martin Indyk. Martin Indyk, before he was in government service, worked for the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is the most influential group within the Israel lobby. How can you appoint someone with this transparently one-sided approach to the issue and expect that the United States is going to be an honest broker? It brings to mind Einstein's definition of insanity, which is doing the same thing over and over and over and over again and expecting that somehow you're going to get a different result. Now, before we open it up to Q&A, because I hate to leave things on such a dour note, what can we do about this? Well, clearly we can't leave it up to the politicians. because the politicians are incapable of brokering a just and lasting Israeli-Palestinian peace because of these lobbying groups that constrain the policy options and that put people like Martin Indyk in control of the policy. We have to take the initiative ourselves. And for all people who care about human rights and justice and international law, and who want to see freedom and self-determination and equality for the Palestinian people, what we can do is we can respond to the Palestinian civil society call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, against corporations that are profiteering from Palestinian human rights abuses by Israel, and by institutions that are complicit in supporting Israeli apartheid. Now, what does that mean in the context of Boston College? What it means is pressing your college to divest itself from corporations that are profiteering from Israel's human rights abuses of Palestinians. So, for example, Caterpillar. Many institutions hold stock in Caterpillar. Caterpillar bulldozers are given to the Israeli military thanks to us as U.S. taxpayers. And what Israel does with these Caterpillar bulldozers is it turns around and it demolishes Palestinian homes. More than 20,000 homes have been destroyed since 1967. It uproots Palestinian olive trees and other agriculture to drive Palestinians off their lands. Caterpillar bulldozers are used by the Israeli army to build settlements, to build this wall that's encircling Palestinians in the West Bank, and for other evil purposes. So is it right for Boston College or any other institution to hold stock in a corporation like Caterpillar that is making money off of the misery and the human rights abuses that are inflicted on the Palestinian people? I think not. There are many other corporations that should be divested from as well. For example, Veolia. Veolia is a French multinational firm that has lots of contracts throughout the world for transportation, bus lines, trains, and also environmental services like waste management and so forth. Veolia provides a lot of these services to Israeli settlements. And so, for example, in Boston, there's actually a community campaign to get the city to drop its contracts with Veolia, which I believe runs the public bus system, the school bus system in Boston. And of course, many institutions hold stock in corporations like Veolia. So what we can do is band together on college campuses and urge our university, or your university in this case, to live up to its creed of supporting justice and supporting human rights by divesting in corporations that are doing the opposite, that are getting wealthy by profiteering from injustice and human rights abuses. And so it's actually a very hopeful movement. And this is actually the same movement and the same strategy and the same tactics that helped bring about an end to South African apartheid back in the 1990s. And I'm convinced that with the goodwill and with the cooperation of people all around the globe who care about this issue, who want to see justice done, who want to see a true and lasting peace established, that we're going to get there. We're going to get there because we are having a huge impact already. So Veolia, the company that I just mentioned, has already lost billions, with a B, billions of dollars worth of contracts because of its involvement in Israel's human rights abuses. We have the power to do this. And I want to urge you to join Students for Justice in Palestine and get involved on campus and help work on these boycott and divestment campaigns here on campus. Thank you very much.
That was a presentation by Josh Rubner, National Advocacy Director of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, on his new book, Shattered Hopes, Obama's Failure to Broker Israeli-Palestinian Peace. And that is it for This Week in Palestine. Please join us again next Sunday morning and every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.